Mass exodus from Twitter. What does it mean? Do not click on those Crash Safari links or the Crash Chrome links. Really, just don't. Also, a Kickstarter game gets delayed again, and fans will not accept an apology. All that and more coming up on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1435, recorded Monday, January 25th, 2016. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT.
And by the Ring video doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Right now, get free expedited FedEx shipping when you go to ring.com/TNT.
And by Igloo Software. Igloo is an intranet you'll actually like. It connects people with the information they need to do their best work. Try it for free at igloosoftware.com/twit or sign up for a live demo to see it in action.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about the tech news with people who get it,
who get the tech news. At the core.
Yes. People who feel
down.
It in here.
Yeah.
They feel technology here. I am Megan Maroney.
And I am Jason Howell with the tech feels. I've got the tech feels
You've got
today.
The feels. In your heart.
In my heart. And in my gut. Joining us today is hopefully someone who also feels the tech. It's Alex Wilhelm of Mattermark. How's it going, sir?
I can confirm I do not feel the tech deep in my gut. So perhaps I should just hang up now and take my ball and go home.
It's okay. We can get there, I think, through the course of an hour.
You got to feel it here or in your gut.
Is this like head, shoulders, knees, and toes?
Exactly.
Yes, version? Totally.
Okay.
That's exactly
it.
You're catching on. You'll do good. Thanks for joining us today. Tell us a little bit about Mattermark. What's that all about?
I'll keep it short. Mattermark is a database of information on private corporations. You can kind of sort and dig through. My job is a little bit different. I'm just hanging out with all of our data and trying to do journalism focused on who's growing quickly, markets, venture capital, all that good stuff. And I've been here now just over 3 weeks, and I confirm that I'm not yet fired. So that's very good.
That's good. Let's see if you can make it to week 4.
I have big hopes to get all the way to February, and right. After that, all bets are off.
You're like, I made it. I have a feeling you're going to have a lot to say about this first story. After a Sunday full of rumors and speculation, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey used his service, to officially announce that 4 key members of the team are leaving the company. That's Katie Stanton, who's the head of media, Kevin Wheel, who is the head of product, Alex Roeder, head of engineering, and then Jason Toff, who's the head of Vine. Although it kind of seems like in Jason's situation, it may have been more his choosing. We don't know of the other 3 whether they all randomly out of nowhere decided to leave at the same time, or whether it was, you know, kind of a higher up call downward. But Jason Toff, you know, took to Twitter and basically said it was a tough decision. I've decided to go to Google to work on VR stuff.
Yeah,
so
you
it may have been
VR.
A different scenario with him, but still 4 very key members of kind of the Twitter executive branch gone.
And Jack Dorsey says they left willingly. He doesn't, I mean, sort of, that's what he said. What do you think, Alex?
Well, I think when you have that number of departures in such quick succession, they're not randomly lined up. I don't know precisely how they did this internally, but they could have been unified on the employee side or the executive side. But what I found most interesting in this was we finally got a CEO to comment on rumors and speculation instead of just denying they were going to do so. Did you guys think that the way he announced the departures was kind of odd?
Well, I thought it was
interesting.
It's like the screenshot of, you know, it's using Twitter, but it looks like using a notes app or something. I mean, it doesn't look bad necessarily, but I'm thinking, first of all, the way he did that on Twitter, just basically saying, hey, you know, after there's all these rumors, I was going to wait and tell everyone, you know, individually, but now I'm going to come out. Maybe the fact that he has to write that way. And plus, if you look at the comments underneath the tweets, there's the, you know, requisite fights of someone saying like, hey, how about you put in a tool so that I don't get harassed? And then a bunch of people harassing that person. So, right. You know, it's like maybe that's the problem. That's why everyone's leaving.
Yeah, right there. Well, I think if you think about Twitter right now, I think we're all still addicted to it, but we're kind of the minority. And so if you're going to have a product-wide shakeup and get more people onto the service, you probably can't do that with the troops you already have. And so to see Jack pull the trigger like this, even if it wasn't quite entirely his choice, but so forth, I mean, maybe this is the rejiggering of their staff they needed to finally have a new direction for the core Twitter experience. Because if they don't make dramatic changes, they can't get user growth growing, and then they're in serious trouble and Jack's fired. So perhaps this is a little more brave and a little less desperate than people originally thought, initially thought, I should say.
New York Times says two new board members to be named very soon. One, a, quote, high-profile media personality.
Maybe it's you.
Ellen DeGeneres. I don't know.
I'm pulling for Megan, honestly. I would sleep a lot better at night if that was the case.
All right. Please let me know in advance, okay, though. As far as the show is concerned, we're going to have to work on some things to make that happen. Big changes up top have been expected since, of course, Dorsey took over CEO last October. At this point, let's see here, Twitter stock kind of taking a hit this year. So people want change and they kind of expect it at this point. So this really seems to be kind of part of that. I do also agree. It's very interesting that he's taking a screenshot of the announcement. But I think that's kind of part of the CEO playbook right now when you happen to run a social network is you use your social network to break big news. And right now, the only way to do that is that we know that Dorsey has plans, has mentioned, at least referred to plans to open up the character limit on regular posts. So maybe this will speed that up. So he's like, any future announcements? I'd like to not have to take a screenshot of them. I'd like to actually just use the service.
Wouldn't it be great if he had announced it on Peach, the popular social network Peach?
Oh, heavens. Please, no. I'm just glad it wasn't on Medium. That was my guess.
Right.
I feel like everyone uses Medium now for their little PR announcements. But in this case, it was a tweet. And that's, I think, at least, you know, on brand. So we can give him points for that.
Yeah. And there has been one kind of late-breaking fill-in, Nathan Hubbard, VP of Global Media Now. So he was the former head of commerce. He also happened to be a former Ticketmaster CEO, by the way. But another thing that I find very interesting about this is if it's a planned thing, why do the planned thing and then not still have your backups kind of lined up and ready in order? Like there's something very ramshackle about the approach.
Well,
you know what I mean?
This is what happens when Kara Swisher and Mike Isaac are both reporting on your changes at the same time.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
true. You
want
to keep something secret. Those two are the NSA of the tech world. So yeah. I don't think he had much of a choice to pull us down the way he wanted to. But given that he's going to announce later this week anyways, I agree with your point that this doesn't seem to be that well ironed out.
Orchestrated.
To minimize the PR impact. Yeah, because their shares were down another about 4 or 5% today again. That's really, really adding up.
Wow. Yeah, at the end of Kara and Kurt's article on Recode, you know, they point out that Twitter is going to have a board conference in San Francisco this week. So maybe that, you know, the timing of that was interesting. They also, you know, mentioned that Recode was not invited to this conference, but they of course will be reporting on it anyway, and we will be reporting on what they report.
Because that's what we do.
Yeah, well, it's reporting all the way down. One thing I heard a while back before the share price really collapsed was that anything below $30 a share was going to be kind of the threshold that they may get acquired at, and now they're something like 17, 16 bucks a share. I don't have it pulled up right now. Yeah. But I mean, they're very much in play, I think, if there's anyone out there who wants to buy them. They're worth about $12 billion somewhere in there. And that's just not that expensive. So I'm curious if the board meeting will consist of how you're going to sell the company instead of how you're going to turn it around. But I was also not invited. So we'll have to see what kind of shakes loose.
Yeah. Maybe we should get together and buy them. What do you guys think?
We could just pitch in our pennies and make it happen. $17 a share right now. $17.02.
There we go. Way. Thanks.
All right, well, let's move on. Here's an update to a story we reported late last week on rumors that Apple plans to release a new and upgraded 4-inch iPhone. The iPhone SE will be an upgraded 5S. It'll look like the 5S, but with rounded edges. But it will probably, now we think most definitely, have the iPhone 6 chip and processor. That's the A9 and the M9, which means always on Siri, for those of us who love that. Also, there will not be a 32-gig version, just a 64-gig version. And the rumor is they will still be the pathetic little 16-gig version that ruins people's lives when they buy them.
The entry level that they end up hating later. Like, why would I do that?
So what do we think about these rumors, the tiny iPhone?
I think it's cool they get the price point down really far. If they can do that and compete with Android on the lower end, that's great for Apple if the margins are strong. But right now, I would never go backwards in screen size. I have the iPhone 6, so I have the middle size version, if you will, but I just love it. I can't imagine having less space for my apps and thumbs. Maybe I'm just bad with my thumbs, but I mean, frankly, a smaller screen is just not where technology is going right now. So if it's not a volume play, I don't understand it. If it is, then it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
It's all about entry level, right? Like, the, you know, on the Mac Pro side of things, they had the Mac Mini, which, you know, tech fans aren't necessarily running out and picking them up. But to someone who has always wanted to get into the Mac side of things and just never quite had the money, having that low cost entry point, even if it's not the best version of their computers in the world, is still an option to get people through the door, and then eventually they end up, you know, ponying up and increasing their spend the next time. So
yeah. Jason, do we know how well the iPhone 5S has sold over the last chunk of time? Because I have no numbers on that, so I don't really know how their lower cost iPhone strategy has worked out so far to date.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, I know that I happen to be married to someone who still has the 5C. C stands for caveman, in my opinion.
Very nice.
This 6SE or 5SE is sort of, instead of creating a 6C, which everyone sort of expected them to, you know, that third tier down, they're just like, well, it's going to have the better processor in it, but be smaller, which is what some people are still asking for, some tiny-handed people.
And I think it's smarter that they're going with if there's rumors to be believed, that they're going with a more recent processor in there, because it's a really good point that, like, once, you know, you hit the middle of the year, suddenly that processor is not one generation outdated, it's two generations outdated. Mm-hmm. And that's not a great proposition for anyone that's buying new technology. You know, that just feels wrong.
Right. And it'll
go for it, sorry.
Oh, it'll have live photos. That was the most important thing that I was going to say.
Is live photos a big deal? Yay or nay? No. Between you two?
Nay.
No. Okay. It's a good selling point. But it's that thing that, like, you have it and people look at it and they're like, ooh, that's cool. I want that. You know, and then when you have it, you don't really use it.
Right.
My thought on live photos is, like, 20 years from now when I'm looking at those photos and I see movement as opposed to just a still picture, it'll be amazing. But right now, the things that I took 3 months ago, not so great.
I just wonder if 20 years from now that standard of seeing the movement is still going to exist, when I'm pretty certain that at least you'll be able to find a image viewer that's going to be able to view your basic image files. And no,
well, by then
there.
We'll have, like, little chips in our head and everything will look like a painting from Harry Potter. So I'm not concerned about it. But
we'll be living live photos.
Life is a live photo.
That's right. The best one available. And we don't even need to upgrade ourselves. Speaking of upgrade, Cortana, which is Microsoft's virtual assistant for Windows devices, is bringing a couple of new productivity features to Windows 10 that revolve around completing tasks and kind of managing your schedule in useful ways, some ways that might sound familiar. First, they're going to monitor your emails to pick out things that you mention in email where you're committing to do something. So you write an email to someone saying, oh, yeah, you know, I'll purchase those plane tickets later. And then you'll get a notice through Cortana that says, hey, you committed to purchasing those plane tickets. You want to do that now? which I think that's very useful. Secondly, Cortana is going to scan for calendar conflicts, you know, traffic and commute issues based on what you have in your calendar, scheduling events too tightly. So maybe, you know, advise you on loosening up. Ultimately, it's just about Cortana being less of a digital assistant in the way that Google Now is, and more of like a digital version of your actual assistant. That's like, hey, would you like some coffee? I noticed something about your schedule. Do you want to change this? A very nice digital assistant, I suppose.
Yeah, it's definitely cool technology, and I'm sure they'll get past the privacy concerns, but yeah. I really didn't wake up today and said, you know what, I want one more thing in my life to nag me. I don't have enough calendar notes, DMs, tweets, emails, phone calls, shows. It's just like, I don't need one more thing being like, hey, give me your attention. I mean, if that disorganized, will this actually really help you too much? I mean, I'm sure for some people it'll be great, but I'm just not that, like, diehard about this particular feature.
I mean, so I'm an Android user. And I pretty much live and die on Google Now, with one feature in particular, and that's the Remind Me feature. I've gotten so incredibly used to reminding myself on X day to do whatever. And this kind of reminds me of that. For me, that works really well for me, because if I don't get that reminder, often I get too spread out. I lose my focus and I forget to do it entirely. So from that regard, yeah, like, this is actually a feature that I would like, for it to kind of scan through the email and do that for me. I would find that pretty useful.
Yeah, I use the reminder, Remind Me, because I use Inbox for Google. So, you know, I have an iPhone, but I use all Google products on it. And I use that reminder a lot. And it doesn't, you know, it reminds me on my Apple Watch. And so, yeah, it is really helpful. It never, like, unless you're setting the reminders, it never seems to tell you the right things. The assistants, I feel like, never seem to tell me the right things. Like, I was flying over the weekend. I wanted it to tell me if my flight was on time or not. It was not on time. And, you know, that was the most important piece of information that I wanted to know, and it didn't tell me.
Right.
So.
What I like here is Microsoft is really investing in Cortana and not letting the product stagnate. And so I think that shows the race between Google Now, Siri, and Cortana, instead of maybe slowing down, it's going to heat up. And I think this is kind of a selling point for their larger service layer across now kind of all mobile platforms. So that's fun to watch. And I'm kind of curious what the next generation of this technology looks like. Because I think this is a smart next step iteration, you know? But I'm curious what the next revolution will be in this technology.
Maybe
I have no idea.
Maybe it's so smart that it does those things that it's reminding you to do.
Yeah, for you.
It knows so much about you and what you might want to do that it buys your plane ticket for you.
Yeah.
No, don't do that, please.
Yeah, my credit card's like, no, don't.
Yes, exactly.
I can't go to the Bahamas this week. That's terrible idea.
Well, now, you know, Alex, you use Macs and PCs, but you're a pretty, you know, you use Windows a lot. You're a regular Windows user. Do you use Cortana on your iPhone ever?
No. I don't really use Siri either. Honestly, I find that I can just type faster. And that's just technology in its current state. But I feel a bit like a Luddite saying that. But no, I don't really use any of the three major assistants, as it were.
And I think one of the problems, at least from what I understand, as far as like Cortana on iOS or even on Android, is that, you know, Cortana shines on its native platform because it has access to all the things that it's been designed to do. Cortana on any other platform brings a lot of those features over, but it doesn't necessarily have access to the underlying things that make it as useful as it might be on a Windows Phone device or a Windows 10 computer. So,
yeah, I use Cortana a lot on Windows 10, just not on my iPhone. So
right,
I
have to launch it.
Right, exactly. That's the other thing, right?
Yeah, it's too many steps. But on your PC, on your Windows 10 device, you can just talk to it and it just fires up for you. So that's a pretty cool experience.
Yeah, you want it to be embedded in the experience and not an extra step.
Right. Well, Alex, as an iPhone user, you will want to follow this story. And Jason, you will want to laugh at this story. Wired.com says there's a website making the rounds that will crash Safari. So don't click it. Some have been reporting that clicking the link will crash your iPad and your iPhone and might even cause your device to reboot, losing a minute or two of your life that you cannot get back. It's annoying, but apparently not dangerous, unless you're in the middle of doing some remote brain surgery from your iPhone. That would be dangerous.
Yeah,
I wouldn't recommend doing that in any circumstance, actually. Don't do remote surgery from any device, let alone your phone. But I'm curious, is this a security flaw or more of a really funny prank? Is this dangerous?
It's not dangerous. And it was a guy that figured it out, that created it. A 22-year-old working on application security in San Francisco created it as a joke. It's JavaScript code that overloads your address bar with an infinite series of numbers just to crash it. And there's also Chrome.
I just crashed my Chrome browser.
Yeah, I was just going to say. okay, interesting that you say that, because I had saw in forums that some users were saying Windows 10, Firefox, and Chrome we're reporting it too.
Well, there's crashchrome.com too, which is the same thing. And that apparently overloads your history until your browser crashes.
Thanks for taking the hit for us, Anthony.
Yeah, right.
So we don't have any more B-roll for that.
All the rest of the links for the rest of the show, totally gone. Oh, so there you go. That was an example of it. Did you see it? All those numbers.
Yeah. This is a reality show today.
This is fun though. It's an old school hack. You know, hacks these days are usually security flaws and zero-day patches and so forth. This is a really fun, almost like prank. You can use this on your friends. Like, hey, man, click this link. Gotcha.
Yeah, it's like
I would not think that was funny.
It's the new Rickroll, because people are, you know, disguising it behind a URL shortener. And, you know, here you go. Like, go watch a normal Rickroll, and nope, it's a Rickroll to the Rickroll.
Well, here,
if you do this to your boss, Twit will give you $20. Just take a video and send in the footage.
That's not the truth. If this happens to you, maybe it would take the time to stop and take a deep breath and just contemplate your existence while you're waiting for your phone to reboot.
Or all of your links to
regenerate. Or your browser,
which just could be a lot of links.
It's a reminder to pause.
Okay.
I think I would shout and yell profane words during that process as opposed to contemplating my own existence. But maybe I'm a little bit more hot-headed than most. I don't think I've enjoyed the experience.
Everybody deals with web crashes in different ways, all right? Everybody deals with it the way they need to.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so first announced last May and then testing for 10% of its users in select markets for months now, Spotify
is now finally rolling out its video product. Android users are going to see it first this week. That doesn't happen a whole lot, with iOS users to follow, they're saying, by the end of next week, but I suppose we'll see. And videos are going to be served up in packages like News of the Week or Laughs at Lunch, clips like short clips, content by providers like ESPN, Comedy Central, BBC, Vice Media. Yes, Twit is among one of those content providers. And
congrats.
Yeah, well, thank you. I had nothing to do with that, but I'm happy to take credit for it. So what do we think? Videos on Spotify. Is this the next big thing for Spotify, and are we excited?
I'm not a Spotify user. I know you are, Alex. So you
I live in Spotify. So to me, if they're going to give me more content for what I already pay, I'm totally in. I don't know how often I use it on a day-to-day basis, but certainly if I'm just, you know, taking a 10-minute lunch break, I'll fire up that, you know, lunch playlist and give it a try at least. I mean, Spotify's done a really great job at curation of music and recommendations. And so if they can take that same expertise and apply it to video, I think our lives will be richer, just not Meg, of course.
Sure. Yeah, I've been using Spotify actually lately. I'm a Play Music subscriber, but I've been using Spotify for a couple months and I actually really like it. And I think I could see how this would be very useful. They say that they're launching it without ads. And they're not necessarily launching it as a we expect to make money off of this sort of thing, at least not in the short term. Obviously, eventually, they would love for it to make lots of money for them. But for right now, it's launching without ads.
Do you think it's kind of weird they're going Android first as opposed to iOS first? Or is that kind of the new norm?
I don't know. I don't know if that's like a, you know, one of those situations where they're like switching it up for their own user base. Or, you know, I don't know if that means that there's something developmentally under the hood that was just easier in their development process for Android versus iOS. I don't know. But they've been testing this for months. So it's kind of hard to think that they wouldn't have it ironed out and it wouldn't be their choice. So yeah, I honestly I don't know.
So how long till it's on Windows Phone? Sorry.
All right. If you are an Instagram user, your Instagram experience might have seemed a little bit more ad-filled lately. That's because it is. Recode reports that Instagram is showing more ads, just as they said they would back in June. They've also allowed third parties to sell ads for them, and those ads appear to be doing quite well. So I guess this is good news for Facebook investors, bad news for people who don't want Instagram to look more like Facebook. Alex, what do you think about this? I mean, this is something that investors look at, like this chart that's on the Recode article really is like, oh, wow, like this is something that's good for investors, correct?
Yeah, well, Facebook makes a lot of money and they don't do that by accident. So I'm not surprised by this at all. And they did pronounce it, as you said. But I think this bodes for other Facebook products. Messenger and WhatsApp, for example, are pretty good examples. Because if they're going to do this to all products they eventually have in their larger galaxy, we should expect similar performance across them in terms of monetization. So Instagram is so big and so popular, and if I may, a lovely app to use, I'm not surprised it wouldn't take more revenue out of it. But I'm curious what the margins are on this, because I don't think Instagram is that expensive to run. So this could be a really good profit source for Facebook moving forward as their core experience kind of matures and slows down around the world.
Right. I mean, that's the thing, that Instagram is lean. It's a lean company. It was just started by a few, you know, a handful of people, and they've been able to run it, even though they're owned by Facebook. They still run it, you know, similarly. I don't get annoyed by the ads. You know, it's
I was just scanning through my feed to see if, like, they were jumping out at me because they're everywhere in Instagram, and I didn't really see them. And, it's, you know, even when you see them, it's kind of hard to know whether they are an ad or not. They seem a little native at times.
Mm-hmm. Well, Instagram is a pretty good platform for ads, given that it's so visual already.
Yeah.
And so if you had a really pretty ad experience, I don't see how it would be too annoying, unless it was really untargeted. But, I mean, if they did it properly, I don't see this really hurting user retention and also making a lot of money at the same time. So it's kind of a win-win-win, because users don't want to pay for Instagram. They still want it to be free. So this is a pretty good compromise between users, brands, and Facebook, I think.
Yeah. Right. I mean, the Facebook ads are ugly. They are.
Yes.
It's not. So, yeah. I mean, maybe they learn from that, and then this will be better.
Yeah.
Do you guys ever see Facebook ads? Don't you run an ad blocker? And then, you know, I haven't seen a Facebook ad in years. I don't know.
I see them. Am I not ad blocking? I must not be ad blocking.
Properly.
No, they're always there. I keep them there because I want to support Facebook. I want to support the little guys, you know.
Yeah, the scrappy upstarts.
Yeah, no big deal. You know, they just run the entire world.
Right. I'm afraid if I use an ad blocker on Facebook, Facebook will go out of business.
They're going to miss your money.
I've read their financials. I can confirm they are not going to go out of business anytime in the next 2 decades. Okay. So don't worry about that.
Okay.
So then neither will Instagram.
Right. And there's an ad for BB-8. So, you know, they know what I like.
Yeah. There you go.
Small Android drone-ish things. Okay. Got
exactly.
It.
Yes.
All right. In a minute, we're going to talk with Ian Thompson of The Register about how insecure hospital tech can be. But first, let's take a minute to thank ZipRecruiter for sponsoring this episode. If you're hiring, but you're not sure where to find the best candidates, that's kind of what ZipRecruiter is all about. The truth is candidates are everywhere. That's exactly the problem. It's not easy to find them. They're buried beneath all the subpar ones, sprawled out among the internet in a million different places. It's like finding a needle in a haystack. As a business owner, your company is only as good as the people that you hire. Posting jobs in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates, and short staffing leaves just very little time to post to dozens of job sites. And thanks to ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites with one single click, and you'll be instantly matched to candidates from over nearly 6 million resumes. They take care of all that heavy lifting for you. You just post once, and then within 24 hours, you watch your candidates just roll right in, and ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface makes it easy to navigate all of those choices, so you can kind of zero in on the ones that are going to bring the most benefit to your business. ZipRecruiter has been used by over 400,000 businesses. You can try it now for free. Check it out for yourself. Getting the right people for your company is so important. I don't need to tell you that. So check it out. Scott, he's a happy ZipRecruiter client. He added this to say. He said, the recruiting process used to be so painful. Before, I'd post to several places. I'd get a million resumes, but only a few responses from qualified candidates. It was torture. But with ZipRecruiter, we post once and get qualified candidates in one easy-to-review place. We've hired some of our best employees using ZipRecruiter. That last line right there, that's what's going to get you to check out ZipRecruiter. Today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And check it out for yourself. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today.
So, Jason, our banks are not safe.
That's true.
Our phones are not safe.
I'm told that's true.
But what about our medical information? That, I assume, is kept out of reach of hackers, right? Well, not according to a report from a recent security conference in San Francisco. Joining us to talk about the state of hospital IT security is Ian Thompson from The Register. Welcome, Ian.
Hi there. How's it going, Megan?
It's going well.
We're scared. That's how it's going. We're scared, man. Thanks.
So you just heard Avi Rubin talk. He's technical director of the Information Security Institute at the Johns Hopkins University, my alma mater. Tell us what he found when he examined the system security of six major U.S. East Coast hospitals.
Well, basically, it was an absolute nightmare. Now, this guy's gone over credit card companies. He's investigated car companies, a whole range of industries. And he said that without a doubt, it was the medical industry, which was the absolute worst when it came to IT security. There's some really egregious stuff out there. For example, there was one case where they had a room full of workstations for doctors. Now, the IT department had said that if you were logged into a workstation and nobody used it for an hour, then you automatically logged out. So they tasked a junior nurse, who's one of their main jobs was to go around and shake the mouse and make sure the passwords are re-input so that anybody could just walk in there and access the entire hospital's records. Another hospital had 8,000 of their staff members having complete access to their databases. Encryption was nowhere to be seen. There's a whole host of things, which is really quite worrying for anybody who has to deal with a medical professional on a day-to-day basis.
So what was the overall point of this talk? I mean, what is it that, about medical devices that, that we're trying to connect to the internet and how they're secure or not? What was the overall point of this talk that you heard?
Well, basically, none of it's secure. He was saying, okay, in terms of hospital IT systems, then, there are some serious shortfalls coming. But then another speaker was coming on talking about medical devices. And even there, the situation's bad. Now, we've known that some of these devices can be hackable for quite some time. But we didn't realize quite how bad the situation was. I mean, one pacemaker had a debug routine in there, which would allow somebody to wirelessly induce an irregular heartbeat, which was meant to be there as a test function. But if you're actually using one of those and somebody's got malicious intent, then that could be really quite serious. And device manufacturers, up until a couple of years ago, really had no concept of building security in their devices. And this wasn't Windows 95 levels of security. We're going back to DOS 2 on this one.
Wow. Is it kind of at least partially a matter of just the sheer fact that in a hospital setting, you need information fast, you need access to things fast. And, we all know that security is inconvenient.
We know that it's necessary, but we also know that it's inconvenient, slows you down. Like, I can totally understand the need for great security in this scenario, and obviously there needs to be a better devised security method for this environment. Maybe that's the lesson to be learned. But there's also a need to get at this information quickly when you're in a hospital environment.
Very much so, and that was something he highlighted. I mean, basically, doctors need to be able to get hold of this information quickly. Customers now increasingly need to be able to get hold of this information online, because a lot of hospitals and medical practices are making records online for both to reassure the patient and also to speed up booking and medicine processes. So all this stuff has to be out there. But he's saying it's either unencrypted or it's encrypted in such a way that the keys are readily available. So, I mean, you've got to basically, that's a wee bit of a problem, you know, if you're looking at it from a security perspective. And also, doctors themselves are part of the problem. He said, you know, the number one problem he listed was that doctors, I mean, from a doctor's perspective, the only thing that matters is keeping the patient alive.
Right.
Everything else can go hang. And they tend to have a bit of a God complex, he said, and they don't really like being told that they're not doing things correctly. And all this didn't really add up to a terrifically great environment when it comes to keeping your records secure.
Is this something we can probably improve on a lot in the next 5 years, or is this like a 25-year problem for medical security in general?
Actually, that was quite comforting. They did say that this is getting sorted very rapidly. And when Kevin Fu was saying that when he went round medical device manufacturers, they're actually building in security at a whiteboard stage. I mean, when you consider it took the medical industry 100 years just to accept that washing your hands after dealing with, you know, patients before going on to the next one might just reduce death rates a bit. It was actually quite encouraging, he said, that, you know, give it 3 to 5 years and most of these problems, 90% of them will be sorted out. It's that 10% that's really going to take some time.
So in the meantime, we should just not get sick, I suppose.
Well, I thought that was the entire medical system, American medical system.
Well, in that case, I'll just, you know, study on then. Keep at it.
Well, you know, it's like I come from a land with socialized medicine, and so it's not such an issue back home. But here, most of the best advice anyone seems to get about the American medical system is don't get sick, or if you do, die quickly before the bills mount up.
The goal of the doctor is don't let the patient die, right? But when we think about the medical industry now, I think about like people being like doctors and the whole system being really concerned with the legal aspects of things. Like, you know, they're going to do this because it's legal. They're not going to share this with you because it's illegal. And this seems like there's a lot of things that are not legal with the way that they're treating our information. Is that just that there is no law? That's kind of the Wild West when we think about that?
It's not quite the Wild West. I mean, there are certain privacy situations, I mean, with the HIPAA legislation that have to be taken into account. But it's a question of that's purely on the medical records. I mean, there's an awful lot more to it. For example, he came across one large, virtually empty room with just a workstation churning out CDs in there. And he asked the administrator, well, what is this room? And he said, well, we used to store x-rays there, but we don't use film x-rays anymore. So now we've just got this computer and it burns CDs with your x-ray on, which are given to patients and doctors. Now, he examined one of these CDs, and it was a Windows CD with the x-ray on, but with software on there, which automatically interacted with Windows to auto-run the minute you put it into an optical drive. Now, if you could get malware onto that system, you're then basically spamming malware out to every doctor and patient who picks up a disc, and it's like a Typhoid Mary for malware in hospitals. It would just spread around the nation very, very quickly. It's basic security practices that are being ignored and I don't think are covered in legislation, no.
But you do think it's getting better?
Yes, definitely getting better. Slowly but surely. I mean, basically, medical device manufacturers didn't even consider security 10 years ago when they were coming up with stuff. And even recently, as we saw with the case of one pump that was found to have some serious vulnerabilities in it, it was a year before the manufacturer actually got round to fixing it. Now, with the flood of bad headlines and the flood of bad press that goes with that, medical device manufacturers are very, very keen to get this sorted out because nothing kills your market like the knowledge that their product could actually kill you. So they are getting, you know, a handle on this, but it just, with the lead times involved in new medical equipment, then it can get very difficult. I mean, he found one MRI machine which was running Windows 95 and said, well, look, why don't you just upgrade this to an operating system that works? So, well, we could, but then we'd have to buy new magnets for the MRI scanner, and it's probably just cheaper to keep it going this way. So you've got long lead times and long lifetimes for the products involved.
And a lot of interdependencies, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So are you going back to the Usenix conference this week?
Yeah. I'm not, I've learned more in the last day than I have in the last 3 days of RSA conferences. No, I mean, fascinating stuff. It's the first of its kind, and it's a really interesting mix. There's only about 450 people in there, but they're not CEOs or CTOs or whatever. It's the people at the coalface. It's the IT admins. It's the people at Google and Facebook and LinkedIn and Goldman Sachs even, who are there just to swap stories, find out what's going on and how to block it in the future.
Well, cool. So I guess we can read about it in the Register this week, your coverage.
Oh, we'll be there. Quite a few press there, but we'll definitely be there. And you should always go to the Register. No disrespect, Alex.
No, I love your stuff, so keep at it.
Oh, right. Cheers, mate. Thank you. And yours.
Ian Thompson, of course, at the Register and at Ian Thompson on Twitter. Thanks so much for joining us. Take care.
Always a pleasure. See you later.
We'll see you soon, Ian. All right. Hey, you can email us at TNT at twit.tv to take part in the show, like Rob from Scotland, who says, I have a tip. Speaking of security, I have a tip with regards to the password manager debate. This is the topic that keeps stretching on into a new week, it appears. What I do is have LastPass generate secure random passwords and then add something short to the end of all my passwords, such as, in this example, BOT7, BOT7. Then I copy-paste my passwords and add the thing at the end. So all he ever has to remember is that last little thing. If LastPass is ever overtaken and that database, you know, somehow makes it out and all those passwords end up in somebody's hands, they'll still do nobody any good because they haven't added the last part. This is an idea that I have not heard before. I was like, that is actually kind of brilliant. I'm sure somebody smarter than me is going to tell me why that isn't, but I thought it was a really darn good idea. No, what do you
well, I think it was until you told everyone how it works. I mean, that guy had a really good game going and you just blew it out of the water. The heck, Jason?
Well, yeah. Hey, he's the one that wrote it.
Right.
It's
don't
my job
use
to
bot
read,
seven.
It's my job to read things you guys write. So there we go.
Do you guys use LastPass?
I do. I use LastPass.
Okay. I just follow suit. I do not right now.
I love it. I think the challenge with LastPass is when you've got an entire history's worth of passwords already created, changing those to be, you know, LastPassified and secure is a big challenge, depending on how many sites you store passwords on. If you could have had LastPass or another password manager from the moment you started using the internet, it would be amazing because you just set it to randomize with all these characters, up to 20 characters or whatever, and every password you create is entirely different. You never have to even think about it because it just saves it automatically. So yes, it's great, but the sooner you start, the better, because we keep signing up for sites and, you know, using passwords, and the longer you keep using the same password or variations of the same password, the more insecure you are. So
right. Well, you should be going in and changing those passwords anyway.
I know. It just takes so long. Like there is no standard for changing a password, you know? If I could just go into LastPass and say, change all these passwords to random, you know, different things across the board, then that's one thing. But every site has its own process. You gotta log in, find a place. It's just not easy. You know, I do it over time.
Right.
Kind of iterative process, if you will.
Yes, exactly.
I'm still waiting for the breakthrough here. I think the way we do passwords is still pretty much archaic and just really, really backwards. And so LastPass is a cool solution to make it easier and simpler, but it doesn't solve the core problems that Jason just outlined. So I can't wait for whatever comes next, because I think this problem is going to get worse, as he said, and I'm kind of lazy. And I have the same password in too many sets right now, and I feel kind of guilty. But also, you know, day job. I don't wake up and think about password security. I think about, like, coffee. So I really would love to have someone out there who's really smart have a better solution to fix all of this across all the stuff we use. Yes. So if you're out there, please get on that.
What if Cortana could do that? Then I would get a Windows phone. If she could change all my passwords for me regularly.
When the overlords come in, though, they'll have all your stuff. So I don't think that's the good long-term solution.
No.
But Satya, if you're watching, you know, that's a product for you. Get on that.
All right, let's take a minute to thank the Ring Video Doorbell. They sponsor Tech News Today. We are all familiar with the sound of a doorbell. Ding, ding. It means a package is being delivered or friends are coming over for dinner. It's also the sound of someone planning to rob you, perhaps. Mm. Over 95% of home break-ins happen during the day, and burglars almost always start by ringing your doorbell to see if you are home, and then they begin pillaging all of your possessions. But With the Ring video doorbell, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world just using your smartphone. Ring's advanced motion detection alerts you even if someone doesn't ring the doorbell. So I have motion detection turned on mine. I know when someone's leaving, when someone's coming, when my children are bringing someone over, that now I know everyone who's going in and out of my house. Also, you should tell people that they're being watched if you have a babysitter over or something like that. Just, you know. If you have motion detection turned on.
It kind of freaks the babysitter out when, like, they're going out for a walk. And you're like, you get the notification and you hop on. You're like, all right, have fun in your walk. They're like, wait a minute, what just happened there? You're talking to me through the doorbell.
Right. Make sure to tell them before you record anyone. With Ring Video Doorbell, you can talk to delivery people and keep an eye on your package. Even if someone tries to mess with it, you will get an instant alert and an HD video of the whole thing. It's like having a neighbor keep an eye on your home 24/7. One of my children was homesick today. I left him at home for a little bit. He's not home alone anymore. But it was so nice to know that if somebody came to the door, that I would be able to see them. If someone rang the doorbell, I just, you know, you can tell your child, don't answer the door when I'm not home. But you don't know if they're going to or not. And this way you can see. It was really, really comforting. Installing Ring takes minutes and it works with either your current wiring or a built-in rechargeable battery. Put your mind at ease and protect your home with the video doorbell. Time Magazine and USA Today named one of their top 10 gadgets of 2015. Go to ring.com/TNT for free expedited FedEx shipping. That's ring.com/TNT. With Ring, you are always home.
All right. Hey, Lauren Hawkinson is here from The Next Web. How's it going, Lauren?
Hi, pretty good.
It's awesome to have you here today. Thanks for joining us. You wrote a piece that illustrates just how difficult it is to give the people what they want when you take your project to Kickstarter. In this case, a game by the creator of the Mega Man series of games. What's going on with Mighty No. 9?
Yeah, absolutely. So back in 2013, a Kickstarter campaign for Mighty No. 9 was underway, and it ended up raising a lot of money, and it's no secret as to why. This is Keiji Inafune, who was in charge of actually the illustration of Mega Man through the NES and SNES years. He, along with a lot of veterans, developers from Capcom, which was the developer of the Mega Man series, sought to create a sort of spiritual successor to Mega Man in Mighty No. 9, and it raised $3.8 million. It was huge at the time. I mean, this is back in, 2013, and the projected date for Mighty No. 9 to be released was around April of 2015. But today, actually, they announced on Kickstarter that the game would be delayed a fourth time. It was supposed to come out in February, but it's now been delayed a fourth time and will hopefully be in backers' hands sometime in spring of 2016.
So, so it was April 2015 was the initial. At the end of April, they pushed it back to September 2015, and then they pushed it back to the Q1 2016, later clarifying, February 2016, and then now this. So, man, it turns out, knowing when you're going to be able to release a video game is really, really hard stuff. Have they given any indication as far as like what the specific issue is here? Because they've been working on this thing for years at this point.
Yeah, so it seems that a lot of their problems are actually a product of their own success. Part of the Kickstarter campaign and all of their reach goals, as they're called, was to sort of create this extra extension into different platforms, you know, going on handhelds, going on consoles, you know, keeping it to not just keeping it to computers, but actually moving onto other platforms. And they found that there is a networking node issue in the game that prevents online matchmaking, which is a feature that will be in the late release. But knowing that that bug exists and actually fixing that bug are two different problems, because they have to make so many different versions of the game for so many different platforms, they've found that each solution is actually a little bit different. And they've been working overtime trying to compensate for the fact that they have this one problem that essentially breaks the game, and it needs to be solved in a dozen different ways, depending on what kind of hardware you're actually running the game on.
Yo, Elhawk, how much money did they raise?
$3.8 million.
We're friends. That's how we talk to each other. was $3.8 million a lot more than they initially wanted to raise? How much did they kind of beat their initial goal?
Yeah, so their initial goal was $900,000.
Oh, wow.
So they cleared that by more than four times over.
So would it have been better to release without this, like,
killer feature that everybody is pining for, and then release that later so that backers get that product now? Or is it good to just kind of keep stringing people? I mean, I realize you don't want to release something that's broken. So, and I don't think anyone wants that. But I mean, at a certain point, you know, I guess you have to ask yourself that question. What do you guys think?
I mean, personally, I'd rather have the game out in a partial format as long as it still functioned. But if it's actually broken so much you can't play it, then there's no point in putting it out. But if it's just a multiplayer bug, I don't know. Depends on how much gamers really wanted that specific feature.
Yeah.
And also, this isn't a theory. This has actually happened. This has been in practice before, where a Kickstarter-backed game has released half of its content and the other half was pushed to a later date. That would be Tim Schafer and Double Fine Entertainment's Broken Age, which came out a couple years ago. And people might widely remember that it also had a blockbuster Kickstarter raising $3.3 million. And they realized right near the end of the initial release date that they had actually run out of money. And so they released the first half of the game on Steam, and the sales proceeds actually went to fund the second half of the game, and people were incredibly upset. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that backers give this money, and they assume because they're giving more money than you asked for, that you're going to be able to do everything that you promise, and then the other promises that you have on top of it. But obviously things happen. You can actually be a victim of your own success. And this is really what happened in the Mighty No. 9 case. And I think that people want the finished product. They paid, you know, almost $4 million and they want that finished product.
Is Kickstarter a good place in general to fund software development, or is it better for hardware projects?
That's actually a good question. And something that is continuously tackled, especially by video game developers, because it's really funny. Gaming development is really nuanced, and there are a lot of problems that can happen when you're trying to build your own video game. Even if you're a veteran, even if you're like the team behind Mighty No. 9 and you have, you know, a bunch of developers from Capcom who are able to make, you know, the dream game that you've always wanted, there are still a lot of unknowns, especially when it comes to production and distribution. And so even if you can solve the equation for having the intelligence and the resources to create the game that you're promising, the actual act of making that game public is incredibly difficult. That said, I mean, there's vaporware all the time on the hardware side. So I think that what you see here is that it's more about the fact that what it comes down to is that when you're crowdfunding for a product, I mean, you're still crowdfunding it. It might not come in the package that you were initially promised. And I think that although the Mighty No. 9 team, I think, will ultimately be able to, you know, do their fans right and sort of serve up the game that they want, and I don't think that there will be any problems on that end in terms of this game getting to market, there's still a lot riding on its shoulders because they did raise such an incredible amount and they have run into these problems.
It's almost like raising a ton of money is not the best PR always, because people, the fans, are more demanding.
I know,
like,
right?
With the Klinkle. The glorious example of Klinkle. Sorry. Yeah. I'm not bringing the mood down right there.
But so they apologized. They said that this is our sincerest apologies. Have you noticed that since they apologized, I guess they just posted that today. I mean, have fans, are they still up in arms about this?
Oh, of course. They're gamers. Are you kidding?
Yeah, I gotta let this go.
they're restless as hell. I would be restless too if I were them. I think that part of it is that when you want to bring something to life, when you're so passionate about something that you're willing to pay for it, even when it's just an idea, even when there hasn't been a single level completed, there's no demo, you are just, you know, buying into the people who are making it and they're buying into the concept. Every tiny disappointment continues to sort of build those fears as to whether or not you actually paid for the product that you're getting. And I mean, gamers are a bunch where if they pre-order something and they hate it, they will return it. Like, this is a very fickle audience. And I think that although the incredible politeness and I would say cultural politeness as well, I mean, I think that a lot of what Keiji Inafune says in that letter is very much like my sincerest, deepest apologies. It's all that. But I think that, you know, at the end of the day, they just want their dang game.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's a good lesson to, you know, you're not buying something when you're backing something on Kickstarter, you know, and
that's a common misconception.
Right. Or, yeah. Yeah. So just a good reminder that
people think that they're actually buying a product, and it's very likely you're going to get that product. Maybe not even very likely. It's likely you're going to get some sort of product, whether you're going to get the product you were promised, you know, that remains to be seen, or if at all.
Should Kickstarter make that a little more plain? Because I feel like we have the same problem over and over and over again with the platform, and people seem to make the same mistake. So should they have like a big warning label, like, you know, you may not actually get what you're promised?
I think they are, and they're making a documentary. I mean, they're paying for someone to make a documentary about, or maybe it's an investigative report, I think, from a journalist that they are paying to do this report on one of the, I think it was the drone.
It was a little micro drone.
Yeah.
And the report came out said it was incompetence, not anything malicious. So they just couldn't pull off what they promised, but they weren't doing it on purpose. I'm not quite sure that makes it any morally different.
Right. I mean, at least they're getting an apology letter, right?
That would make my day. You know, if I paid that much money for a drone, the letter would do it.
Yeah, and you're going to get your product. I mean, I guess that's the thing. It's like, if you are lucky to get your product, you know, it depends on the time and the condition that product arrives. Yeah. You know, you might get what you asked for or what you were, you know, that might come on time, but it might not be exactly what you promised, or it won't have the specs, or it won't have, you know, the levels or anything. I wouldn't discourage anybody from crowdfunding. I have backed many, mostly software. I don't back hardware. That's a little bit too rich for my blood, but I back software, and I find that, you know, as long as you are willing to stand behind the creators, you know, you're going to be pleased.
Yeah, the game looks quality too. Mm-hmm. I want to play it. I was a big fan of Mega Man, so it's
really Mega Man-y. People who've played it, played the demo versions, it's very, very like Mega Man. So if you like that kind of complicated platformer, you know, he has the different suits, he fights all the robot enemies, like, it's going to feel just like that.
Awesome. Lauren Hawkinson, thank you so much for coming on and talking all about this today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
People can find you at The Next Web and L. Hawkinson on Twitter. We'll have you back soon. Thank you, Lauren.
Sounds great.
Take care. Well, TNT's fan of the day is at @Q_Davis on Twitter, who posted, "I've been a fan for years. I watch via YouTube using my Google Nexus player to #nerdandchill.
Nerd and chill.
Oh, my. I was scared.
Yo, baby, you want to come over and nerd and chill? We'll watch some tech news today. No big deal.
I mean, I would say yes to that, but I don't think
Well, show us how you watch or listen to TNT. You can post it on Twitter, Google, Instagram, Google Plus, Facebook, Peach. Use the #HowIWatchTNT, and we will find it.
Peach is still a thing, by the way.
It's still
a
thing.
Does Peach have more users than Google Plus?
I don't know. I think it's just me and some other people, but
that's mean, Alex. That
I was trying
mean.
To be mean, but Peach was really fun for a whole afternoon. I had a real blast.
People just like the new shiny thing.
I'm still there just in case it becomes the next thing. I'll be there.
Yeah, I have a username.
What's your Peach username?
Megan Maroney. I'm Peach.
Keep it simple. There you go.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Add her on Peach.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a couple of How I Watch TNT send on Peach.
Peach
so it happens. It happens.
I stand corrected.
All right. Coming up, you're not alone. Even NFL football players feel like crying when their tablets won't connect to the network. But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode. That's Igloo. Anyone who's worked in a corporate environment knows how painful legacy intranets can be. The content is stale. The interface is ugly. You can only access it while you're at work. Igloo is an intranet you'll actually like. It's a cloud platform that helps you do things like share files, collaborate on your documents, your blog updates, coordinating your calendars, managing your projects. It's built using responsive design, which means everything you can do at your desk, you can now do on the go through any web browser, wherever you happen to be. And anyone can add content based on their permissions, of course, with drag and drop widgets, as well as a WYSIWYG editor. What you see is what you get, so it makes it very easy to do so. Igloo also offers a variety of access, authentication, and identity services to ensure that only authorized users have access. So that's in private clouds, over SSL, and with 256-bit encryption. Now, unlike other solutions, you can customize Igloo to fit your needs and work with your current IT investments like, you know, Salesforce, SharePoint, Active Directory, and then coming soon, file sharing solutions that you might be using, Box, Dropbox, just to name a few. It's great for growing companies and large enterprises that are looking to refresh their communications strategy. And it's used by government agencies, companies like Hulu, Inventive Health, American Family Insurance, IP Switch, all of those, and
more. So you should try it for yourself. Try it for free. It's igloosoftware.com/twit, or sign up for a live demo. And you can see it in action. And when you sign up through our link, you can get your own igloo for up to 10 people absolutely free for as long as you want. That's igloosoftware.com/TWIT. And we thank them for their support. It's little surprise that NFL players and coaches rely on technology on the sideline to do things like reviewing plays, defense, all that kind of stuff. So what happens when that technology fails? Well, what do we do when technology fails? We get very mad. And what do you know? NFL players are people, too. New England Patriots saw their Microsoft Surface tablets experience significant network issues during yesterday's game, the AFC game. Loss of connectivity for 20 minutes. And if you watch, well, if you care about sports ball at all or watch football, 20 minutes could lose you the game. Turns out the New England Patriots did not have their great day yesterday. They did lose. I don't know if it was a result of this, but their opponents, the Denver Broncos, did not experience any issues. They could continue using the tablets. Should be noted that this is not an issue with the tablet itself. So this isn't like, wow, Microsoft Surface tablets really suck. It was a network-specific issue, but just kind of interesting because Microsoft spent millions to get in into this deal with the NFL, I think back in 2013. And ever since, you get so used to seeing players like beating up on the tablets because either they don't like what's happening or the tablet isn't working for them or whatever, banging it on their heads. And this is just another example of where technology goes wrong.
Yeah.
You know, for $400 million, you can buy a lot of stuff. I wonder if there'll be a positive ROI on this NFL deal for Microsoft.
Who knows? That you know, failed technology is no press is bad press, including when technology fails on TV.
That's probably not totally accurate, but
there's a lot of people that are like, what's the Surface? Like, you know, when I don't know.
Well, there was a huge debacle when they kept calling them iPads all the time when they weren't. That was so embarrassing for Microsoft. They did train people, I think, to not say iPad.
They did.
That was rough. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, the branding here is big. I mean, I watched football. I'm not the world's biggest fan, but I enjoy sports. And, you know, if I was an average person out there, I probably haven't seen a Surface in the wild. They're not that mass market yet. So maybe these could have a positive impact. But if the story is they didn't work, then you're probably moving backwards and not forwards at a very high cost regardless.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those stories that makes it easy for people who maybe aren't as much fans of technology and don't like the direction of technology taking over things that normally, you know, what did they do before this? They had printouts, you know, they basically had printouts sent down and they had their playbooks and they could see what the other team was doing in a printed form, and now it's on a screen. But what happens when that goes out? You're out of luck for 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it's like, see, technology's bad.
Well, you had to ride your horse and buggy down the stadium with your new set of printouts to hand to the coach, and then buggy went back up to get the next set. So it's very Gutenberg. I mean, obviously this is a much better solution, but I'm just really curious, what was a problem that only affected one team?
Yeah, very strange.
It was for some hacker, and they're like, oh, I don't like the Patriots, and good call on hating the Patriots. They're horrible, and they should lose every game. But I'm curious how it only hit them. You know, it's a really weird intra-stadium network issue. I mean, it'd be fun to look into that.
Yeah. That
you do that and get back to us.
Both teams aren't on a shared network.
No, I'm not. Not at all.
Well, that's something for Ian Thompson. We should ask him to look into
that. Yeah, it is kind of interesting that both teams weren't on a shared network. They're on their own isolated network.
Suspicious.
And how fair is it that one team had access and the other team did not, huh? Mm-hmm. They could continue playing the game with that leg up.
The Broncos were going to win anyways, so too bad, all right, Patriots fans.
All right. I know we lost at least a couple of people by talking about football, and I'm sorry. I hope you come back tomorrow.
You almost lost me. Can we stop talking about football now?
All right, let's do it.
Thank you, Alex, so much for joining us. Alex, are you a reporter, an editor at Mattermark? What is it, a writer?
My job title is editor-in-chief, but I do a lot of writing as well. So it's kind of a blended role, if you will, right now.
And, of course, you're at Alex on Twitter because you were there first.
No, I bought it off a guy in Mexico in 2008.
You were the smartest.
Yes, the smartest.
For buying it in 2008 versus now.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you couldn't buy it. Twitter's actually banned the policy, so you can't actually do that anymore.
All right.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Alex,
for coming on.
It's our pleasure.
As always, pleasure.
All right, take care.
Take care.
So
Megan's out tomorrow.
Yeah.
And the next day.
And the next day.
What are you doing to me, Megan?
My mom is turning 70 and I'm celebrating her birthday.
I understand. So to get back at you, I'm going to be out on Friday.
Yes.
Take that.
And I will be here. Actually, we don't get along anymore. And now, from now on, we're never going to be on the show together.
Yeah, this is our last show together. I hope you enjoyed it. No, not true. Only the next couple of days, and then we'll have a glorious Thursday before I'm gone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have Father Robert Ballester back in studio tomorrow. Also, my cohort from All About Android, Florence Ion, also of Greenbot, she writes for Greenbot, is going to be on tomorrow. So I hope we have at least one like Android-y, Google-y story. But we have a lot of interesting stuff to talk about, including an interview with Vahini Vara, who wrote the cover story of this week's issue of Bloomberg Business Week, regarding diversity and inclusion of black coders in Silicon Valley. It's a really, really fascinating article. I'm really looking forward to talking to her about it. So we're going to have that on tomorrow's show. TNT records live every Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can always be a part of the show by emailing at tnt@twit.tv, or you can leave us a short voicemail. That's 260-TNT-SHOW. And we are on Twitter. The show is at Tech News Today TV.
We are also on Facebook.
We're there.
Facebook.com/Tech News Today, and leave a comment there. We post parts of the show on there. And if you want to know about our upcoming guests or get some behind-the-scenes gossip, you can do that by subscribing to our newsletter. Sign up for that at twit.tv/newsletter. And don't forget to subscribe to the show however you subscribe to podcasts.
All the places.
On iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, or now you can get it on Spotify soon.
Soon.
All the ways to subscribe right now, you can find at twit.tv/TNT. And you can get in touch with us directly on Twitter. I am at Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. Thanks to our live producer, Anthony Nielsen, and all the awesome people who produce this show behind the scenes each and every day. And thank you for talking tech with us today. And we will see y'all tomorrow. Bye, everyone.